Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. We look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From the New York Times, peddling relief, firms put debtors in deeper hole, and this is by Peter Goodman. I started this article last week and am continuing. Linda Robertson knew nothing about the industry she was about to encounter when she picked up the phone at her Missouri home in February 2009 in response to a radio ad. What she knew was that she could no longer manage even the monthly payments on her roughly $23,000 debt in credit cards. So much had come apart so quickly. Before the recession, Ms. Robinson had been living in Phoenix, earning as much as $8,000 a month as a real estate appraiser. In 2005, she paid $185,000 for a three-bedroom house with a swimming pool and a yard dotted with hibiscus. When the real estate business collapsed, she gave up her house to foreclosure and moved in with her son. She got a job as a waitress, earning enough to hang on to her car. She tapped credit cards to pay for gasoline and groceries. By late 2007, she and her son could no longer afford his apartment. She moved home to Kansas City, where an aunt offered a room. She took a job on the night shift at a factory that makes plastic lids for packaged potato chips, earning $11.15 an hour. Still, her credit card balances swelled. The radio ad offered the services of a company based in Dallas with a soothing name, Financial Freedom of America. It cast itself as an antidote to the breakdown of middle-class life. "We negotiate the past while you navigate the future," read a caption on its website, next to a photo of a young woman, nose-kissing an adorable boy. The American dream. It was never about bailouts or foreclosures. It was always about American values like hard work, ingenuity, and looking out for your neighbor. When Ms. Robinson called, a customer service representative laid out a plan. Every month, Ms. Robertson would send $427.93 into a new account. 3 years later, she would be debt-free. The representative told her the company would take $100 a month as an administrative fee, she recalled. His tone was, "Take charge." "You talk about a rush through," Ms. Robertson said. "I didn't even get to read the contract. It was all done. I had to sign it on the computer while he was on the phone. Then he called me back in 10 minutes to say it was done. He made me feel like this was the answer to my problems and I wasn't going to have to face bankruptcy." Ms. Robertson made 9 payments according to Financial Freedom. Late last year, a sheriff's deputy arrived at her door with court papers. One of her creditors, Capital One, had filed suit to collect roughly $5,000. Panicked, she called Financial Freedom to seek guidance. They said, "Oh, we don't have any control over that, and you don't have enough money in your account for us to settle with them," she recalled. Her account held only $1,470, the representative explained, though she had by then deposited more than $3,700. Financial Freedom had taken the rest for its administrative fees, the company confirmed. Financial Freedom later negotiated for her to make $100 monthly payments towards satisfying her debt to the creditor, but Ms. Robertson rejected that arrangement, no longer trusting the company. She demanded her money back. She also filed a report with the Better Business Bureau in Dallas, adding to a stack of more than 100 consumer complaints lodged against the company. The Bureau gives the company a failing grade of F. Ms. Robertson received $1,470 back through the closure of her account, and then $1,120, half the fees that Financial Freedom collected. Her pending bankruptcy has cost her $1,500 in legal fees. "I trusted them," she said. "They sounded like they were going to help me out. It's a ripoff." Financial Freedom's chief executive, Corey Butcher, rejected that characterization. "We talked to her multiple times and verified the full details," he said, adding that his company puts every client through a verification process to validate that they understand the risks, from lawsuits to garnished wages. Intense and brooding, Mr. Butcher speaks of a personal mission to extricate consumers from credit card debt. "But roughly half his customers fail to complete the program," he complained, "with most of the cancellations coming within the first 6 months." He pinned the low completion rate on the same lack of discipline that has fostered many American ailments, from obesity to the foreclosure crisis. "It comes from a lack of commitment," Mr. Butcher said. "It's like going and hiring a personal trainer at a health club. Some people act like they have lost the weight already, when actually they have to go to the gym 3 days a week, use the treadmill, cut back on their eating. They have to stick with it. At some point, the client has to take responsibility for their circumstance." Consumer watchdogs point to another reason customers wind up confused and upset: bogus marketing promises. In April, the United States Government Accountability Office released a report drawing on undercover agents who posed as prospective customers at 20 debt settlement companies. According to the report, 17 of the 20 firms advised clients to stop paying their credit card bills. Some companies marketed their programs as if they had the imprimatur of the federal government, with one advertising itself as a national debt relief stimulus plan. Several claim that 85 to 100% of their customers completed their programs. "The vast majority of the companies provided fraudulent and deceptive information," said Gregory Kuntz, managing director of forensic audits and special investigations at the GAO, in testimony before the Senate Commerce Committee during an April hearing. At the same hearing, Senator Claire McCaskill, a Missouri Democrat, pressed Mr. Ansbach, the USOBA lobbyist, to explain why his organization refused to disclose its membership. "The leadership in our trade group candidly was concerned that publishing a list of members ended up being a subpoena list," Mr. Ansbach said. "Probably a genuine concern," Senator McCaskill replied. On multiple fronts, state and federal authorities are now taking aim at the industry. The Federal Trade Commission has proposed banning upfront fees, bringing vociferous lobbyists from industry groups. The commission is expected to issue new rules this summer. Senator McCaskill has joined with fellow Democrat Charles E. Schumer of New York to sponsor a bill that would cap fees charged by debt settlement companies at 5% of the savings recouped by their customers. Legislation in several states, including New York, California, and Illinois, would also cap fees. A new consumer protection agency created as part of the Financial Regulatory Reform Bill in Congress could further constrain the industry. The prospect of regulation hung palpably over the trade show at this Atlantic Side resort, tempering the orchid-adorned buffet tables and poolside cocktails with a note of foreboding. "The current debt settlement business model is going to die," declared Jeffrey Tenenbaum, a lawyer in the Washington firm Venable, addressed a packed ballroom. "The only question is who the executioner is going to be." That warning did not dislodge the spirit of expansion. Exhibitors paid as much as $4,500 for display space to showcase their wares, software to manage accounts, marketing expertise, call centers two attendees who came for 2 days of strategy sessions and networking. Cody Krebs, a senior account executive from Southern California, manned a booth for LowerMyBills.com, whose internet ads link customers to debt settlement companies. Like many who have entered the industry, he previously sold subprime mortgages. When that business collapsed, he found refuge selling new products to the same set of customers, people with poor credit. "It's been tremendous," he said. "Business has tripled in the last year and a half. The threat of regulations makes securing new customers imperative now before new rules can take effect," said Matthew G. Hearn, whose firm, MSTARS of Minneapolis, trains debt settlement sales staff. "Do what you have to do to get the deals on board," he said, pacing excitedly in front of his podium. "And if some debt settlement companies have gained an unsavory reputation," he added, "make that a marketing opportunity." "We aren't like them," Mr. Hearn said. "You need to constantly pitch that. We aren't bad actors. It's the ones out there that are." And that's from the New York Times article by Peter Goodman, "Peddling Relief: Firms Put Debtors in Deeper Hole." If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And we continue our examination of the two-income trap, which is a work by Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi. And we're looking at the reasons why middle-class parents are going broke and some solutions to the biggest crisis families face today. I start with an important credit, as the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two-Income Trap. You can also revisit all of the shows that have been produced by going to the archives at www.kruufm.com and look under Life and Debt, so you can visit and learn from all of the shows that have been made regarding debt issues. For a couple of weeks now, we've been talking about regulation of the lending industry, which Professor Warren calls re-regulation. Professor Warren has pointed out how critical the need for regulation is, but how much resistance there has been to this concept. As she said, the mantra of expanding access to credit has been hard for consumer activists and politicians to abandon. As a result, reform efforts have fragmented into a patchwork of measures intended to curb predatory lending practices. But the problem is that no one can agree on how to define predatory lending. As The Economist dryly observes, as with pornography, consumer activists and legislators say they know predatory lending when they see it. The National Housing Institute defines predatory lending as any unfair credit practice that harms the borrower or supports a credit system that promotes inequality and poverty. But what constitutes unfair, and who decides whether a system is promoting inequality or poverty? Attempting to stamp out predatory and unfair practices is certainly better than ignoring them, but it puts legislators in the position of trying to uncover the latest shenanigans and redefine abuses, always 2 steps behind the lenders who keep changing their products to sidestep regulations, which we're already seeing with the new credit card lending law that came into effect this February. There is always too much room for lenders to circumvent the intent of the law when the terms aren't precisely defined, and there's no loopholes in the situation. For example, the New York State Banking Department banned unaffordable loans except under compelling circumstances. So any crafty loan marketer could dream up some compelling circumstances that would permit a lender to sell overpriced loans. The only way to stop predatory lending once and for all is to go directly to the heart of the loan, which is the interest rate. Limiting the amount of interest that creditors can charge avoids the hide-and-seek game over what is and what is not predatory, offering instead a simple, effective means of regulation. In order to achieve the real dream of credit democratization, it's time to recognize once and for all that families are not better off getting credit at double, triple, or even 10 times the market rate. In fact, this is quite unconscionable. If a family does not have the income to qualify for a loan at a reasonable rate, then they should not get that loan, period. It does no one any favors to impose a modern-day debtor's prison on hardworking families. They would be better off renting an apartment and putting whatever extra money they have into savings rather than paying double the market rate for a mortgage, for example. If the private market cannot meet the needs of all communities, then it may be necessary for the government to step in to provide alternative sources of credit. The point worth emphasizing is that overpriced credit is never a solution. Getting robbed to buy a home or to get a cash advance is still getting robbed, and Professor Warren emphasizes it should be illegal. So in her review, she says that America's crippling addiction to debt could be shaken off with a simple regulatory change, which we've discussed in the prior shows. But what are the politicians doing about it? Well, the answer is, even through today, quite simply, nothing that is effective. We still have the growing number of foreclosures. We have the credit card debt soaring, and we have bankruptcy lines that stretch out into the street and around the block at the courthouses, and Washington has not really effectively offset any of these problems. Now there's a lot of talk, but there's been no real substantial progress on any proposal to rein in predatory lending, no real measure to control credit card fees, no proposals to ban creditors from trying to collect from a dead person's brothers and sisters, and certainly no bill to bring back meaningful limits on interest rates that doesn't have huge gaping loopholes in it. Now, certainly a lot of time has been spent on these issues of late, but there has been no change in the lives of the people being affected by all of these practices. It's curious that in 2005, Congress paid close attention to one troubling statistic, which was the rapidly growing number of families filing for bankruptcy. High interest rates and aggressive marketing of complicated debt products resonated through the bankruptcy statistics as record numbers of families sought refuge in the bankruptcy courts after getting in over their heads with too much easy credit at exorbitant interest rates. So in 1994, actually, when this all started to come up as a major concern, that is the number of people filing bankruptcy, Congress created a bipartisan commission to study the issue. The group's charter was relatively straightforward: to investigate why so many families were in trouble and to develop recommendations to improve the situation. Elizabeth Warren was named senior advisor to the National Bankruptcy Review Commission. After 3 years, the commission delivered its report to Congress. The 1,100-page document detailed why so many families were in trouble: job losses, medical problems, and divorce, and identified certain leading practices that put families at particular risk. More important, it affirmed that the bankruptcy laws were, for the most part, working as Congress had originally intended, to offer families a fresh start in the wake of financial and personal disaster. It concluded with recommendations for modest legislative changes that were designed to curb abuses by both borrowers and lenders. But the Congressional Bankruptcy Commission was not to have the final word. While the commission was busy gathering facts, holding hearings, and analyzing current practices, another group also went to work, advancing a very different perspective. And that was the National Consumer Bankruptcy Coalition, NCBC, which is a clever moniker of the banking industry lobby, which was pushing its own agenda. The major banks had hit on a new strategy to reduce their bankruptcy losses. Rather than stop lending to families in financial trouble, as Professor Warren had counseled Citibank in a story we told in the past, they had a simpler and more profitable solution: restrict the rights of consumers to file for bankruptcy. This seems to make sense from their perspective. If fewer people could turn to bankruptcy for relief, more families would be subject to collection efforts from banks and every other creditor forever. Those families might never pay off their bills in full, but they would continue to rack up the interest and the penalties, and at least a few would make some small payment every month, effectively becoming lifelong profit wells for the creditors. For the rest, those who simply could not come up with the money, no matter how hard they were squeezed, the lenders might eventually write off some of the loans voluntarily. Although one wouldn't guess it from all the fiery rhetoric, bankruptcy filings account for just a fraction of lending industry losses. In the large majority of cases, the bank simply gets tired of trying to collect. But if a family were not permitted to file for bankruptcy, it would be the lender, not the family, in trouble that would decide when collection calls should stop. Remember, bankruptcy gives the troubled family some control over the circumstances. And so the banking industry drafted a new bankruptcy law. To get all the lenders on board, the coalition added changes that would give better deals for car lenders, mortgage lenders, education loan servicers, landlords, credit unions. Now, in short, better deals for everyone except the families that were in trouble. The credit industry moved fast, persuading two friendly congressmen to introduce their bill in September of 1997, a month before the official Bankruptcy Commission was scheduled to release its report. From then on, all eyes were on what Hillary Clinton would eventually dub that awful bill. The awful bill was long and complex, couched in virtually unreadable prose. But to a trained bankruptcy lawyer, the intent was unmistakable. That is, to undercut virtually every protection in the bankruptcy law. Under the proposed legislation, child support payments would no longer take precedence over all credit card debt. As a result, more single mothers would be forced to compete with professional collection agents when they needed money from their bankrupt ex-husbands. Homeowners who had fallen behind on their mortgages would be prevented from catching up on past due house payments until they had also paid off their credit card debts, increasing the likelihood of foreclosure. Families would no longer be able to free themselves from certain unsecured debts, so they would be required to make payments, plus penalties, late fees, and interest, on some of those bills for the rest of their natural lives, even if those payments took up 100% of their paychecks. So this was the proposal that the credit industry was working towards. To win over legislators, credit industry executives lobbied extensively and donated more than $60 million in political contributions. This was followed by a public relations strategy that would make any spin doctor proud. As Professor Warren puts it, instead of telling the public that the bankruptcy reform bill would improve profits for credit card companies and giant banks, not exactly the most sympathetic group, the NCBC and its supporters in Congress announced that the bill would help the American family. To quote Democratic Representative Rick Boucher, "The typical family in America pays a hidden tax of $550 each year because of bankruptcies of mere convenience." Where he got this figure from, no one has ever been able to figure out. But the implied promise, repeated so often it has become an article of faith, was that changing the laws would put $550 a year in the pocket of every bill-paying American family. Well, that certainly sounded good. After all, who wouldn't want some extra cash? But there were a few serious problems with this claim. First, the figure is a gross exaggeration. According to the NCBC, the same banking lobby group that generated the $550 promise, only 100,000 of the 1.5 million families who file for bankruptcy each year could afford to repay some of their debts. In other words, under the proposed bill, those 100,000 bankrupt families would be expected to generate $550 for every household in America, since the other 1.4 million are already tapped out. So, Professor Warren did the math. Suppose the law changed, and those 100,000 families could no longer seek protection from the bankruptcy courts, and they were forced to repay as much as they possibly could. In order to return an amount that added up to $550 for every American household, each one of those bankrupt families would have to repay more than $550,000 in a single year. In Professor Warren's sample of more than 2,000 bankrupt families, not one owed $550,000, let alone earned enough money to repay that amount. But even if a magic fairy somehow gave all the bankrupt families every dollar they needed to repay their debts in full, what makes anyone think that the banks would pass that money on to consumers? As we saw in the recent bailouts, in terms of billions of dollars that were given, the banks did not pass that money on to the taxpayers. In fact, they used some of it in various circumstances to lobby against changes in the bankruptcy law
that would benefit taxpayers.
So recall that the credit card industry got $10 billion windfall from falling interest rates in the year 2001 that they did not pass on to their customers either. Why would this supposed $550 per family be any different? Nevertheless, the combination of intense lobbying and a good cover story had its intended effect. Despite President Clinton's veto, the bankruptcy bill was introduced in the next session of Congress. And as we discussed in the past, this time even Senator Hillary Clinton bowed to big business. She had been in office 2 months when she had her chance to vote on what she called that awful bill. Sure, the official bankruptcy commission had better credentials than the banking lobby. Yes, her husband had actually appointed the chairman of the commission and two of the commissioners. And she clearly understood that families in trouble would be hit hardest by the proposed changes. But the bankruptcy commission did not make campaign contributions or have its own lobbyists. And neither do families in financial trouble. Senator Clinton had taken $140,000 in campaign contributions from the banking industry, and she proved willing to overcome her strong reservations about whether this bill is both balanced and responsible, and voted in favor of that awful bill. And of course, we could stop with the story there,
but the next part of the story for Professor Warren, when she wrote and published her book, which was before the current recession in about 2003, she said that this all could have been looked at as a loss. However, she will go on and tell how the response from people, particularly women, to this bankruptcy bill staved off its passage. And we will discuss that in more detail next week.
This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy, prosperous, debt-manageable life.